This is KUOW's The Record. Thank you for tuning in. As you just heard a moment ago, Seattle and state officials were clearing out that homeless encampment under I-5 known as the Jungle yesterday when a Seattle police officer shot and killed a man there who was involved in a knife fight. The clear out of the Jungle was suspended. It has now resumed. We'll tell you more about the people involved in that shooting as we learn more. But this is part of a larger question hanging over Seattle. What to do about homelessness? The latest proposal would increase the amount of time people are allowed to camp on public lands. Council member Tim Burgess thinks this is a mistake. I talked to him and a supporter, Councilmember Mike O'Brien, who says it's a disgrace to our city that anyone is sleeping outside.
In a city like Seattle that can create wealth like we do, that we have not figured out a way to shelter everyone in our community is a failure on all of us, and we have to be working swiftly on solutions to get everyone into housing. At the same time, today there are 3,000 people that have no shelter, and tonight they're going to sleep somewhere in our city. And our current policy that doesn't allow camping anywhere, yet doesn't enforce it on any sort of systemic basis, is failing everyone. It's failing the neighborhoods who say, people should not be on my play field. When they get swept, they come back. It's failing the folks that are homeless, who are continually being displaced. And it's failing us as taxpayers because we're wasting city resources on a program that doesn't work at all, and we can do better programs.
So this is a big picture. In the picture of camping and permissiveness, what's your vision for where people can camp and for how long?
What my proposal would say, and this is something we've been working on and refining with a number of advocates in the community from various aspects, would say, look, we have to prioritize the public space that is least desirable. So the places that are unsafe or unsuitable. So that would be play fields, parks, play areas, active spaces in parks, sidewalks, school grounds. These are places that we would explicitly say no one should be camping here. And if someone shows up at a place like that, we can move them immediately if they're present. If there's no one there, we could move their goods off to the side and wait 24 hours to confiscate them so that whoever needs to use that place can use it. But what we have to recognize is they have to have somewhere to go. And our current policy doesn't do that.
So which public spaces are left after play fields and schools, et cetera?
That's the challenge. So it would need to be unactivated park spaces. So right now, we are sweeping people out of what's called the Jungle, under I-5, which is state property, but the green belt above that. There are people that have camped there for a long time, and when we flush those folks out and they show up at University Playfield a few blocks from here, that makes everyone's situation worse. Instead, we need to prioritize and say people should not be camping at University Playfield, but the greenbelt above I-5 for now may be acceptable until we find permanent solutions.
Okay, Councilmember Tim Burgess, why shouldn't Seattle let people camp in unactivated greenbelts and planting strips until there are adequate places for them to go?
So I agree with Mike that no one should be sleeping outside, which is why I'm so perplexed about this ordinance, because it in effect creates the right to camp on public property in the city, and it incentivizes that. And I think that's exactly the opposite approach. It doesn't solve homelessness. It won't move one person from outside into safe shelter or a home. It doesn't address alcohol or chemical dependency. It doesn't address mental illness or any of that. And I think there's just a much better solution that would actually address the core problem rather than creating this right to camp in some public properties around the city.
What is your solution regarding camping?
I don't think we should create the right to camp in our city.
Public space.
Public space, yes, correct. So I would do four things. I would focus on the philosophy of housing first, which actually started in Seattle a couple of decades ago, but has not really been taken to scale. So I would really keenly focus on that philosophy. I would increase the number of people who are doing outreach, and I would change the focus of our street outreach so that it is primarily focused on moving people from outside to inside shelter. I would expand our emergency shelter options. We currently operate 3 authorized encampments in the city, Ballard, Inner Bay, and Othello in southeast Seattle. Those are well managed and are working well. I think it's better to have people in those kind of encampments that are organized and well managed than having them sleeping ad hoc around the city. And finally, I would expedite the mayor's recommendations that are included in the Pathways Home recommendations on how we clear out the backlog in our emergency shelter system. We have people living for months and years in our emergency shelters, and we should address those needs.
Are you saying that today we do have adequate places for campers to go right now, and right now there should be no place in the city where we let them camp? Or are you saying, yeah, off in the future, there's a lot of agreement. We're proposing lots of things. What about today?
So we're going to open a navigation center in Seattle by the end of the year that will provide 75 more emergency shelter beds. It's modeled after a very successful program in San Francisco. That'll bring us almost to 4,000 emergency shelter beds.
That's enough?
Our consultants say that is enough. They have said that by the end of next year, everyone who is unsheltered can be in shelter. That's a bold claim on their part, but I think it's a worthy goal to be working toward and working toward urgently, as opposed to the legislation that has been suggested, which would allow people to camp in our parks, the unimproved areas of our parks, and on sidewalks all over the city.
But that could be changed, right? Councilmember O'Brien is saying he doesn't support that either. Are there enough votes on the council that might stay in the law that people can camp in the end zone of a park while a league game is going on?
I don't think any of my colleagues are saying that people should be able to camp in the end zone of a football field.
Well, that was a famous example.
It was a very famous example, and it illustrates a core problem we have in the city. That camper was there for days before the city would finally act. And I drove by 3rd and Denny today, right on the south side of Seattle Center. There's a little pocket park there, a triangle. I counted 9 tents and about 6 people there. The sidewalks are all blocked. That park cannot be used by anybody else. City government has, because of the conflict and the confusion around this issue of homelessness, we've become paralyzed. So even in those areas where I think we would all agree people should not be camping, we fail to act. And this ordinance perpetuates that confusion, perpetuates that conflict, just like the city of Portland experienced, which was a disaster in Portland.
Councilmember O'Brien, then, what could the city do to not allow camping in the parks, in the places where you're both agreeing camping shouldn't happen?
There's a lot we can do. And I want to say that the long-term solutions that Tim brought up, I agree with. I don't think there's any disagreement we should work on that. But 75 beds by the end of the year, when I have 3,000 people outdoors tonight, and the end of next year maybe having enough room for everybody, doesn't solve today's problem. And the problem of someone camping in the end zone is a problem under today's rules and regulations. Those rules are broken. The easiest thing for me to do politically, to be clear, is to simply talk about long-term solutions that we all agree on and say no one should be sleeping outdoors, but not offer an improvement for today. What I propose, the draft that I posted with the op-ed that ran in the Times on Tuesday, talks specifically about if someone's camped in a place that is unsuitable, so an end zone, a play field, a dugout, a sidewalk, this wouldn't be allowed in sidewalks throughout the city. You could remove that person immediately if they're present. You have to go through the protocols. You have to offer them shelter if it's available. You have to facilitate their move to a place that they will not be evicted from. So we have to identify places that they can be. Because simply chasing folks around is a waste of our money, and pretending that somehow the existing system is working is it's just so disingenuous with the public. We have to do something different today. The goal, of course, is that no one is sleeping outdoors, and we need to work swiftly to that, but we can't perpetuate the system that's happening today.
Well, let's talk about the rights of people without shelter and the people with shelter. Someone emailed the city council saying that if the city's more permissive toward campers, quote, you will create greater distrust and spite toward the homeless. And Exhibit B, I believe this is one of your constituents, Councilmember O'Brien, emailed saying you will, quote, will only attract more criminals, junkies, and alcoholics. They'll be camping in front of houses with taxpaying citizens, lots of whom have children. We will be scared to walk into our front yards and enjoy our homes. Please don't turn every neighborhood and park of our city into a urine and excrement-filled magnet for delinquents. Now, you've already said that that's not your intention. But are you concerned about this perception that, wait a minute, who has a right to live here without trash and needles and petty crime, et cetera?
We all have a right to live here, housed and unhoused. We all have a right to public safety. We all have a right to clean city. that email perpetuates a myth that is not fair. There are 3,000 people sleeping outside tonight in our city, and each one of those folks has a unique story as to why they're there. There's the gentleman who had back surgery and got addicted to opiate painkillers, and when his doctor cut him off, he went to heroin. There's the woman who's fleeing domestic violence, and the VV shelters are all full, and so she's hiding in the woods in our city, living in fear that her perpetrator is going to find her. There's the LGBT youth that whose family has rejected her sexual orientation, and so she's come to the city as a place of refuge. There's thousands of other stories like that, and we need to find space for them. We need to find space indoors for them, but in the meantime, let's find a space where they can be outdoors and not disturbing folks. That, you know, folks are saying, Mike, I'm frustrated that people are camping in my playground and you can't move them for 3 days. I understand that. That is today's existing policy that's broken. My proposal would say, look, people cannot camp there. We have agreement that you could remove them immediately by moving them to a space that is more suitable. Now, I don't want to pretend that this legislation fixes everything, because there's a lot of folks that say there's zero suitable places in our city and they should just be moved out of our city completely. But we're not going to do that. And so we have to prioritize. What are the places folks shouldn't be, and what are the places folks should be allowed until we find solutions?
Councilmember Burgess, you're hearing his take on what is realistic and what is compassionate. What is your vision?
So I agree with much of what Mike said, and I cringe when we hear emails like the one you read. Every one of these persons has dignity and value, and they need to be treated fairly and compassionately. I have no problem with that at all. But parks and sidewalks are held in public trust. And to say that we are going to allow the right to camp in those areas violates that public trust in my mind.
But what about the green belts, the unactivated spaces, as Councilmember O'Brien?
Where are those?
Where are they?
I mean, right now, in Mike's alternative legislation, people will be able to camp in Magnuson Park and Woodland Park and Golden Gardens Park. They all have unimproved areas. And so once we start down that path and the city officially sanctions that kind of activity, we will have Portland's experience, which did exactly the same thing and was a disaster.
Now, what about the Portland experience? People didn't get the message, and Portland was overrun. They pulled the plug and said this was a failure to allow more camping.
So Portland did a different strategy. We're learning from that. Portland did not restrict any area. They said folks can camp anywhere, but they restricted the time of day.
That's not
correct.
Camp
overnight.
That's not correct. They had geographic restrictions and time of day restrictions,
and
just like this ordinance says.
It was supposed to be camp for the night and move on.
Exactly, and they weren't moving on. But instead, because the challenge of saying we're going to set up a tent and move you in and out, just like our current shelter system, in and out every day, doesn't work for too many folks. They need a stable place to be, even if it's in the woods. And I'd ask, you know, Tim, I'd ask you, I would love to take all park space and all public space off limits, but where are those 3,000 people going to be? And if you have a space for 3,000 people to reasonably live in our city tonight, I am happy to remove the places that aren't suitable and make that. But I'm not going to take all of the land off and say, I don't know, because that's the system today. And they're just going to go to the places that are unsuitable and unsafe.
So there's another big elephant in the room that we need to talk about, and that is many of these individuals, when they are offered services and offered shelter, decline to accept those. We've seen that at the jungle. I mean, many people accepted, many people turned down the services. There were 42, I think, that were left. And yesterday, the city had to remove those individuals.
There's no argument about that, right?
No, there is an argument.
Okay. Sorry. Well, let Tim Burgess finish.
So, you know, this ordinance, as it is written, including Mike's substitute version, basically says that an individual has a right to camp in these public areas indefinitely. Now, they may have to move after 30 days, but they can move 100 feet away and that process starts over again. And I just think that's a fundamental mistake in our city to allow people to camp outdoors when it does not solve homelessness.
So, and first, to be clear, you say it basically says that. It actually doesn't say that. What it does say is it prioritizes the places where we will remove folks. It doesn't say you have a legal right to camp anywhere, but it states a city policy that we will not remove folks from certain spaces until we have adequate housing. And this
which creates a permanent right of camping in the city.
Doesn't create a permanent right. I mean, that's what we have right now. We have it's not allowed to camp anywhere in parks, but we don't remove them until we randomly show up when someone's not there and confiscate their belongings. That's not working. The other idea that folks are unwilling to accept services, again, that perpetrates this myth that there's these 3,000 people out there that really want to camp outdoors because they think this is a great living space. That is not true. There are individuals with mental health crisis that when I walk up to them who they've never met before, representing a system that has failed them all their life, and say, I got a piece of housing. Would you like to come into it? Yeah, they're going to say no until I can build some trust. And sometimes that may take months to do. There are also individuals that say, you offer me a shelter bed that's going to kick me out at 6 in the morning. I got 3 bags full of my personal belongings. What am I going to do with that? I am better off in a tent in the woods where I can at least leave my belongings while I go to work, while I go get services. The shelter doesn't work for me. So we got to stop perpetuating this myth that these 3,000 people out there are simply refusing services. They're not making homelessness a choice. It's a lack of good choices for them that leads them to this, and we have to give them better choices to solve the problem.
Until we continue this discussion, I must give the last word to Councilmember Burgess.
So our obligation in city government is to balance our compassionate response and our public health and safety obligations we have as city government. This proposal does not do that. And so I'm advocating, and I think the people of Seattle are advocating for a balanced approach that is both compassionate and protects our public access to parks and sidewalks and our safety and health obligations.
Seattle City Council members Tim Burgess and Mike O'Brien discussing this controversial idea in some camps of letting people camp possibly for as much as 30 days in some public spaces until they have adequate options, depending on how you define adequate. The City Council was supposed to vote on this Friday, this coming Friday. Well, today that vote has been postponed. You have a voice in this. If you're in Seattle, how do you feel? What do you want your government to do about letting people camp in public places? If you're outside Seattle, how's your community handling homelessness? Tell us what you have learned. Who should we talk to? Send your story to record@kuow.org.
Hi, I'm Karen Mathis, General Manager of KUOW. From all of us here at KUOW, thank you for making the fall membership drive so successful and efficient. Because of your tremendous response, we were able to raise all the money in half the time. Thank you for making what we do possible. We've returned to regular programming, but if you missed the drive, you can still participate with a gift right now at KUOW.org. Then enjoy another stretch of great public radio. Thanks.
You're catching up on the news with KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. A storm is coming, starting tonight, and we want to know how bad it might be. Forecaster Andy Hainer with the National Weather Service in Seattle. Hello, Andy.
Hi, good afternoon, Bill.
What can we expect from this storm?
Well, first, we're going to be looking at rain moving into the metro area late tonight. It's going to be raining tomorrow, but the wind will first pick up in earnest, at least later tomorrow evening. So during the overnight hours tomorrow night, we'll be looking at southerly winds around 30 miles per hour with gusts up around 45 to 50 miles per hour. So we need to keep our sights on that. But what really has our attention especially is what could be coming along on Saturday.
Yeah, I've heard 50 to 70 miles an hour. What are you hearing?
Well, I would say there is a 1 in 3 chance of getting winds that strong. What you've just described is a worst case scenario.
Okay.
1 in 3 chance. The best case scenario, which I would say there's about a 2 in 3 chance of the best case scenario that I'm about to describe, and that is another little mini windstorm with sustained winds around 30 with gusts around 45 to 50. That would be later Saturday. What we know about what's happening Saturday is we have the remnants of a West Pacific typhoon that are going to move into the Northeast Pacific. It's going to deepen, and we're looking at an impressive storm center over the ocean. Now, what we don't know is exactly where this is going to track, and that's going to make a huge difference in the forecast for the wind on Saturday. If it tracks off to the north into Vancouver Island, we end up with the best-case scenario. If the low tracks right across western Washington, which is a 1 in 3 chance, we end up with the worst case scenario.
Okay, so a 1 in 3 chance of 50 to 70 mile per hour winds. Then we are all wondering what to do with that. If you lived here a while, Andy, you're used to wind and rain, especially in October, November. So do you, should we be thinking about taking unusual precautions?
I would say so. 50 to 70 is not the kind of windstorm we see every year. And again, I want to emphasize 3 days out, 3.5 days out, that there's a 1 in 3 chance of that happening. But even that much chance with a windstorm of that significance, that kind of windstorm, that would be the type we get only every few years, if that. It would cause, widespread damage. I'm sure hundreds of thousands would be out of power with a windstorm of that magnitude. So people should get ready now, if they're not already, for, among other things, power outages. Are your electronics charged up? Do you have gas in your car? Do you have working batteries in your flashlights? That's the kind of thing that you can think about now. And even if we end up with the best case scenario working out, at least you're prepared for what could come. It's still mighty early in the storm season.
You probably remember a man killed by a falling tree in Seward Park in a big windstorm. Seattle says it has no plans to close city parks. Are you saying stay away from big trees or old trees?
I wouldn't want to be near anything like that, especially in the worst case scenario on Saturday, although even the best case scenario gives you reason for pause for venturing out in the midst of standing dead trees, basically.
I'm supposed to go to a woodsy kids camp in Port Orchard surrounded by trees. Should I rethink that?
Stay tuned to the forecast.
Yes. Okay. Well, stay tuned. I hope the 2 in 3 chance comes through instead of the 1 in 3 worst case scenario chance. Andy Hainer, forecaster with the National Weather Service. We'll check back in with you as we get closer to that storm.
Thanks, Bill.
Thank you very much. Flashlights, batteries, keep them charged. Have some instant coffee around if coffee is key for you. You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. Let's talk now. Let's move from big windstorm to the possibility of a big earthquake, because as part of Seattle's Emergency Preparedness Month, people got invited yesterday to ride the Big Shaker Earthquake Simulator. So KUOW's Catherine Banwell took the ride.
My name is Dean Reese. I'm the CEO of Ready America.
And where are you based?
San Diego. We have an office here in South Seattle as well.
I can't stand.
No.
I wouldn't want to.
But you can lean.
Is that what you're saying?
You can lean. You're at your own risk if you're standing.
No, forget it.
I'm going to sit. So how many of you experienced the Nisqually earthquake? I believe it was in 2001. If we get the earthquake occur that's just off the coast here, it's going to create an earthquake that we've never seen. So while we had some buildings go down, we will have much more structural damage. You will have utility failure. Potentially, you could be without food, water for up to 2 weeks. So you need to make sure you have your own stockpile established in your own home, okay? It's also important that you're able to survive the earthquake. So we want you to, within your own home, and look at those items that could fall on you or your children or grandchildren and secure them. Your top-heavy furniture, your TVs, electronics, your items on the walls, all of your breakables on the shelves that you could secure easily with earthquake putty. Because the problem is, here in Seattle, an earthquake could happen, I mean, just like that.
Yeah! Wow, fun!
All right.
That was a ride!
Yes.
So what did you think of the experience? It didn't last very long, but it was pretty rocking and rolling in there.
Yeah, it didn't last long, but it started unexpectedly, so it was kind of a shock when it started, and it was pretty bumpy. I didn't expect it to be so bumpy and rattly.
What did you think?
It was really sudden, just like an earthquake normally is, and everything was falling. It seemed to go by really fast, but I think that's how it feels when you're right in the middle of an earthquake.
And you?
I felt okay. Luckily, it went by pretty quickly. I think if it had continued, I would have maybe felt ill. but it certainly was startling, and I was shaking myself a little bit afterwards.
Does it give you any ideas of how you can better prepare for the next earthquake, whenever that's going to be?
Yeah, I learned a lot in there. I thought that it made me kind of rethink about what I'm doing personally in my own home and how I can restructure some of my shelves and pictures on the walls.
Me too. I think I have a lot of things that aren't secured down, and so it definitely makes you think about it. What I have hanging above my bed and things like that.
I'm Matt Offlick, and I'm the public education coordinator with the Office of Emergency Management.
Why is the City of Seattle doing this?
Well, we're always trying to raise awareness of the earthquake risk that we face in Seattle and motivate people to prepare. We really need people to be self-sufficient after a large earthquake. So the earthquake simulator is a way to raise that awareness, get people to know what it's like to be in an earthquake, and then hopefully connect them with a lot of the resources we have here on how they can get prepared, how they can get training.
Woo-hoo! Fell on the floor.
That was Colleen Anderson, Marcy Oliveri, and Gabriella Garrett talking with KUOW's Catherine Banwell there at the simulator, the Big Shaker Earthquake Simulator. And you can find out about more earthquake-related events going on all this month. Check the city's emergency management calendar at seattle.gov/emergency. And we have photos and we have videos of Catherine's Big Shaker Day at KUOW.org. KUOW's The Record. I'm Bill Radke. This presidential election has been bitter, especially when it comes to immigration. That has KUOW's poetry correspondent, Elizabeth Austin, thinking about one poem in particular. She talked with our arts and culture reporter, Marcy Silman.
Marcy, every time I hear a reference to building a wall or keeping certain populations out of the country, I can't help but think of a poem by local writer Karen Finney Frock.
Karen Finney Frock, I know that name. Isn't she a novelist or a poet?
Exactly. She's a performance poet and a novelist.
So what's this poem that you think of?
Her poem is called The Newer Colossus. And if that name sounds vaguely familiar, it's because it's a riff on the title of Emma Lazarus' sonnet, The New Colossus. And that's engraved on the pedestal of the Statue of Liberty.
You're talking about the one that goes, give me your tired, your poor, your huddled masses yearning to breathe free.
Exactly. So the Emma Lazarus poem was written in 1883, and it's in the voice of the Statue of Liberty. And it imagines the statue declaring a welcome to new immigrants. But Karen Finney Frock's poem imagines what the Statue of Liberty might have to say today. Let's give a listen.
The Newer Colossus. My feet have been wilting in this salt-crusted cement since the French sent me over on a steamer in pieces. I am the new colossus, wonder of the modern world, a woman standing watch at the gate of power. The first night I stood here, looking out over the Atlantic like a marooned sailor, plaster fell from my lips parting, and I said, give me your tired, your poor, like a woman would say it, full of trembling mercy while the rats ran over my sandals and up my stairwell. I was young then and hopeful. I didn't know how Europe and Asia, eventually the Middle East, would keep pushing their wretched through the bay like a high tide. I am choking on the words I said about the huddled masses. They huddle on rafts leaving Cuba, and we turn them back. They huddle in sweltering truck backs crossing the desert, and we arrest them. I heard about a container ship where three Chinese hopefuls died from lack of oxygen, pretending to be dish rags for our dollar stores. How can we not have room for them? We still have room for golf courses. I'm America's first liar. Forget about George Washington. My hypocrisy makes me want to plant my dead face in the waves. The ocean reeks of fish and tourism. My optimist heart corrodes in a salt wind. Give me your merchandise, I should say. Give me your coffee beans. Give me your bananas and avocados. Give me your rice. We turn our farmland into strip malls. Give me things to sell at my strip malls. Give me your ethnic cuisine, your cheaply made plastics. Give me, by trembling boatload, your Japanese cars. Give me your oil. Not so I can light my lamp with it, but to drool it from the thirsty lips of my lawnmowers. Give me your jealousy, your yearning to crawl inside my hollow bones and sleep in my skin made of copper. Look. Over there is New York. Doesn't it glow like the cherry end of a cigarette? like a nebula from the blackness of space out here in the harbor, wait with me. Watch it pulse like a hungry lion until morning. I should tell you to enjoy it from here. You will never be allowed to come in.
Oh, my gosh. That was very intense. Seattle writer Karen Finifrock reading her poem, The Newer Colossus. And Elizabeth Austin, the original poem is one about optimism and hope. This is anything but that.
Exactly. And, you know, Karen told me that one of the things that prompted this poem was a real event that happened she recounts in the poem, this incident where several hopeful immigrants who were trying to come to the United States stowed away in a container. And by the time the ship reached Seattle, three of them had died. And that incident melded in her mind with her own early experience of the Emma Lazarus poem and with visiting the Statue of Liberty.
As a child, when I learned the poem, The New Colossus, and when I first learned about the Statue of Liberty, visited the Statue of Liberty when visiting New York City, those were ideals that I internalized about the country that I grew up in and a belief that I cherished as a child about the country I grew up in. And so, you know, part of me writing the poem was certainly me growing up and realizing that, you know, the ideals are not so simply held or always held or even necessarily held by everyone or necessarily something that we can ever say we truly held as a group.
So, Elizabeth, is there a particular part of Karen Finifrock's poem, Newer Colossus, that comes to your mind?
Yeah, just as you were able to recite that Emma Lazarus line about the tired and poor from memory, which I bet many of our listeners would be able to do also, I keep hearing Karen Finifrock's line about refugees, how can we not have room for them? We still have room for golf courses. For me, that image perfectly captures a kind of cynical decadence that is not what I hold dear about my country, and it crystallizes it in a succinct image and phrase. That poem resonates on a lot of levels, raising this question, who are we as a country? But that's the line that kind of haunts me.
Well, thank you for bringing that poem in, Elizabeth Austin. You can read more about Karen Finifrock's other work and hear this poem again at our website, kuow.org.
So Elizabeth was inspired to bring us that poem by the way we're talking about immigration and refugees here in this election season. Today in the campaign, Republican vice presidential nominee Mike Pence was campaigning at the Virginia Evangelical School, Liberty University. And Pence said, although Donald Trump has been heard bragging about groping women, Christians cannot sit on the sidelines here. They need to vote Trump.
Shortcomings are no excuse for inaction. If we were perfect, in a word, we wouldn't need Jesus. We're far from perfect. We do need him. But God's love eclipses our failings.
We'll go to Liberty University for more later this afternoon today on KUOW's All Things Considered. Still talking about election campaigns now, in this case, the money behind them. This year, two wealthy Southwest Washington businessmen have emerged as major donors to state Republicans. Billionaire investor Ken Fisher and developer Clyde Holland are stepping up their contributions as control of the state legislature hangs in the balance. Olympia correspondent Austin Jenkins reports in collaboration with the Seattle Times.
First, let's meet Ken Fisher, number 184 on Forbes' list of billionaires. He's a guy who will talk presidential elections and their effect on the markets on Fox Business News.
Because presidents don't really have as much power as people think they do.
But he did not respond to our request to talk state politics, even though he's an emerging investor in who controls Olympia. One person Fisher does talk state politics with is Republican State Representative Liz Pike.
He's kind of been a legend in my district for a while.
Pike represents Camas, Washington. It's a small city on the Columbia River where Fisher chose to relocate his $71 billion investment firm from California. But Pike says her first contact with Fisher as a freshman lawmaker wasn't about business.
And I get this email from somebody that could be him And it was about fireworks, of all things.
It turns out that Fisher is a fireworks fan and appreciated Pike's opposition to any state bans on personal fireworks. From there, the two got to be friends. So besides fireworks, what does Fisher care about?
A predictable business climate, and he makes no bones that it's going to be a lot easier for him to leave the state of Washington than it was as a fourth-generation San Franciscan to leave the state of California.
In fact, back in 2010, when a high earner's income tax was on Washington's ballot, Fisher said there was no way he'd make Washington his corporate headquarters if the measure passed. It didn't, and Fisher did make Camas his firm's headquarters. But now Washington Democrats are talking about a capital gains tax, something Republicans call a gateway drug to a full-blown income tax. Whether that's motivating Fisher or something else, so far this year he's given more than $100,000 to House Republicans. So has another Southwest Washington businessman. Clyde Holland is a Vancouver-based apartment developer with billions of dollars of projects in the western United States. He also did not respond to requests for an interview.
You know, they are major donors, no question.
That's Kevin Carnes, who's the strategist behind House Republicans' quest for the majority. He says the Fisher and Holland money is vital to compete with majority Democrats who currently have a 2-to-1 fundraising advantage. He recalls a meeting with both men last spring.
You know, these are smart guys, very shrewd, and they had already done their homework.
Carnes says Fisher and Holland see that for the first time in nearly two decades, the House majority is within reach for Republicans. He says they also know that
unequivocally, the 48 members of the House Republican caucus won't vote for a state income tax, hands down.
Democratic State Representative Joe Fitzgibbon has a different take on the Holland and Fisher money. He chairs the House Democrats' reelection efforts.
For a modest investment of $100,000, they see the ability to buy a majority that will not ask the wealthiest to pay more in taxes to pay for our schools.
Holland and Fisher have also been generous contributors to anti-tax activist Tim Iman's efforts to make it harder to raise taxes. Republican State Representative Liz Pike says her wealthy constituents are just trying to bring some balance to a state that's seen mostly Democratic rule for the past three decades.
For me, it's refreshing to have business people, job creators who actually live in this state, have invested their own fortunes in this state, who want to see a better business climate.
Besides supporting House Republicans this year, Fisher has also contributed $100,000 to a political action committee that's trying to defeat the Chief Justice of the Washington Supreme Court. And Holland has given more than $400,000 to the state Republican Party. In addition, both Fisher and Holland were listed as hosts of a recent Donald Trump fundraiser in Everett. I'm Austin Jenkins in Olympia.
That story was produced in collaboration with the Seattle Times. You're listening to KUOW Seattle. I'm Bill Radke, so glad you're listening, and we're live tweeting the show at KUOW. Tonight, it's time to stop being polite and start getting real. Again. MTV's The Real World Season 32 premieres tonight. It was filmed here in Seattle this time, much to the annoyance of some residents and bar owners. Salon's TV critic Melanie McFarlane did the hard work of watching it for you.
So the first Real World Seattle was seven people who were living in a pier that was redone by a very nice local architectural firm. That was actually the season of the Slap Heard Round the World. That was probably the most famous thing to happen out of that season.
This was one of the roommates slapping the other.
One of the roommates slapping the other. And so when they came in, they seemed to get along initially, but then there was a lot of tension. But the main thing is, back then, the production was focused on getting them out to be part of Seattle. So they all had jobs, and one of them had a job tossing fish at the market, you know, so they were supposed to be experiencing Seattle very much at that time. And Seattle did not necessarily want them there. So that actually led to a little bit of difficulty with production.
Now MTV is back. They've been filming here all summer, and it's on TV. What's The Real World up to now?
Well, with The Real World now, it has been changed. The format's been remarkably changed since back in the late 90s. Now it's called The Real World Bad Blood.
Are you saying they're exploring conflict in a reality show? Now I'm interested. I mean, this is new. Sorry, go on.
Well, let me tell you what happens. So a few years ago, the Real World format was tanking because it had become very just cloned and diluted beyond belief. So Buna Murray, which is also a production company behind Bad Girls Club, which all they do is they put a bunch of women in a house and watch them tear each other's weaves out. They decided to inject a little bit of that energy and that format into the real world. So for the past couple of years, you have had a brand that's very familiar, but with a format that injects tension and conflict very purposefully. So this time it's the real world Bad Blood. And the whole idea is that there's a twist, and the seven people who are living in the house don't know that they're going to have relatives and people from their past with whom they've had conflict come into the house and stay with them.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
What about how Seattle comes off? We're different. Seattle's different. How do we look in this show?
Well, back in 1998, Seattle was much more, known as a music town. And there was still a lot of that left that we got to see in the production.
Post-grunge.
Post-grunge, yes. Now Seattle is much more of a tech town. And since the production has changed, the locations we see are much more about going out and on a regular basis seeing them go and party at their local bars. There's a scene where they go to Cupcake Royale to take a selfie. It's less about Seattle as a city, except for the B-roll of beautiful vistas and, shots of the sound and that kind of thing, the Space Needle. The most of Seattle that we see is actually in the first episode where they're all meeting in odd places that are obviously chosen so that you can get the Pike Place Public Market sign in the background and things like that.
So if you're apt to be depressed by this kind of thing, you're thinking, oh, it's MTV, but the music's long gone and it's about getting drunk on Capitol Hill.
Not even getting drunk on Capitol Hill, specifically getting drunk within a house on Capitol Hill. Yes, there is getting drunk on Capitol Hill, and you get to see them go out and grind on each other at, say, the garage or something. But, I think much more of the drunkenness happens within the house, and that way that the conflict is kind of limited to this very specific and well-designed arena.
We gave them a pretty hard time in 1998. Seattle rejected the toxin. How'd it go this time?
Well, my understanding is this time there were a number of bar owners that were ready. My understanding was MTV circulated a contract to the businesses around the house, and some of the bar owners and business owners did not sign it. Others did. So, in terms of just their interaction, like I said, it's very limited. You get to say like, hey, they're going into the unicorn. But they're just going into local businesses up there, and you get to see the sign as they enter. You get to see them kind of, rub their butts up against each other and or, spank other patrons, and then they go back and do the real drinking at home and then, start crying and running into the confessional in their underwear and things like that. It's good times.
Yeah. It sounds like good TV.
It's
bottom
really,
line.
Yeah. I mean, it's right up there with Breaking Bad and Mad Men.
Yes.
Really worth your
prestige time. Television.
Right, prestige television. Indeed. It was interesting viewing last night in my house.
Did you just watch this because of KUOW, or review this for Salon?
No, and I wanted to say to you guys, as the listeners and you, Bill, that never doubt my love and esteem for all of you, because I only watched this for this moment here, just for you guys.
And you're saving us from it.
Yes. Think of me as your shield maiden, out ahead of the, just go the other way. I already took the hit. You don't need to watch this.
Shield Maiden Melanie McFarland and a Salon TV critic. Thanks, Melanie.
Thank you. 'Cause baby, now we got a bad love. You know we used to be bad love. So take a look at what you've
done. Baby, now we got bad love. Now we got problems, and I don't think we can solve them. Or maybe we're just old. This is KOW's The Record, tuning you in there to the Real World Season 32. You can watch for yourself. Thank you for tuning in. It is 12:54. In the news, we've been talking about it here on KOW, and there's a place nearby that's way ahead of us. Seattle might become the first American city to give people a sanctioned place to use illegal drugs. I said first American city, not first North American city. Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer. Hi, Vaughn.
Hello, Bill.
Vancouver's had a safe injection or safe use site for a dozen years or so. What goes on in there?
Well, we've had it for 13 years in sight to the downtown east side, and these things are set up to reduce harm, to let people shoot up in a safe place, to prevent overdoses, and to reduce some of the nuisance in the neighborhood so you don't have the streets littered with needles and all that. So it's done all that. Insight's been in operation for 13 years. They still have not recorded a fatal overdose. It's helped reduce harm in the neighborhood. And in that sense, it's been a great success. Every medical survey, every bit of scientific research, and there's been a lot of it because it's had a lot of attention, has concluded that it accomplished what it was set out to do. Which may lead to the most obvious follow-up question, which is, if Insight's such a great thing, how come it's still the only one in Canada?
Right. We're talking about copying the Vancouver model. I wondered, are other Canadian cities copying the Vancouver model?
Well, you know, what you see if you look through the Canadian news media on this is the city of Toronto is considering doing the same thing. There are other cities in British Columbia, Kelowna, Surrey, Victoria, Kamloops that are thinking of doing the same thing because they have the same problem, not on Vancouver's scale. And the reason it hasn't happened elsewhere is because of a difficulty that I think you're going to have in Seattle, which is finding a place to put it. Vancouver's downtown east side, for better and mostly for worse, is a unique neighborhood. It is such a wasteland, to be crude about it, that there really was no controversy about locating Insight in the middle of it. The place was already, a wreck, so they stuck it down there in the middle of it, and all the addicts were down there. It wasn't like they attracted people to it. The problem was already there. The problem every other place that's ever discussed this is theoretically people support the idea, but it's very difficult to find a place to locate the clinic because it will become a magnet for addicts, and there aren't other communities where the site is as obvious as this one.
So right where Insight is in downtown Vancouver, there have been virtually no complaints from people who live and work right nearby?
Not really. I mean, there's been some, but they recognize that really it brought the problem indoors off the street.
Mm-hmm.
So compared to what goes on in the streets, and used to go on even more on the streets in the downtown east side, there has been relatively little controversy. I would say it was accepted from the beginning that that's where the problem was and that this would get it indoors and reduce the harm associated with it, and it's accomplished that. But it's, as I say, it's been very difficult to find, for other communities that support the idea, what you tend to get to is an argument about where do you put it, and nobody wants one of these near them. And there aren't, in smaller BC cities, even in the city of Toronto, they're struggling to find a location. They're looking at three, but they've not, you know, crossed the margin to say, okay, here's where we're going to put the first one.
You haven't mentioned any argument about whether this is truly a compassionate thing to do, to allow people to use these drugs, whether we're enabling is the word we're hearing here in Seattle and King County. Is that a settled argument?
Well, I mean, the previous government in Canada didn't much like them, and they put in a lot of restrictions. So there is that argument. The medical health authorities, the experts in drug addiction, are generally consistent on this issue. It doesn't increase drug usage. It doesn't necessarily reduce it, but it does reduce the harm associated with it. It gets the problem off the street. It ensures that when you're having something like we're having right now, which is this epidemic of fentanyl,
mm-hmm.
The people that are getting fentanyl in their drugs, at least they're in a clinic where they know how to deal with the problem right away. So you're having a big spike in overdoses at Insight in Vancouver, but you're also having medical authorities there who deal with it quickly, so they still haven't lost anyone to an overdose. And as you know, that's not what's happening with fentanyl everywhere else. We've had, more than 400 deaths in British Columbia from fentanyl this year. None of them were at Insight.
Yes, that's right. And in the United States, well, worldwide, one of the most famous being Prince, who apparently was had fentanyl in his possession. So maybe as the crisis gets even more deadly, maybe that changes the conversation. We've been talking with Vancouver Sun columnist Vaughn Palmer about the Insight Clinic, the safe injection site that Vancouver's had for 13 years, as Seattle and King County consider doing that here. Vaughn, it's always good to talk with you. Thank you for that.
Good to talk to you, Bill. When people talk about this, ask them what it's supposed to accomplish. And if they tell you it's harm reduction and reduction of public nuisance, that's what these things do. They do not cure and stop drug addiction.
That is a conversation we are going to have with more and more intensity here in the Seattle area. Vaughn, thanks for that.
Bye-bye.
You're listening to The Record on KUOW 94.9 Seattle. News and information. We are live tweeting the show at KUOW, and remember to get a podcast of all of KUOW's programs, iTunes, or where you get your podcasts. Thanks for tuning in.